So, I have a lot to say about this session. This session, I think there's a lot of good material in here. Lots of it, really. He says a lot of good things. And I'm probably not going to touch on a lot of the good things he says. And the reason for it is because I only have a half hour. I want to make sure there's time for questions, because I'm sure you guys have some. And the second thing is, he does get some things wrong, and I want to make sure I address those. Because, as you might guess, the writer of the book, not the guy on there, Mark, Mr. Strauss, not him, but the writer of the book, Gordon Fee, who wrote this chapter, was on the committee that formed the NIV 2011. I don't know if you picked up on this, but they really want you to read the NIV 2011. They really think it's something. But because of that, in my opinion, he was a little misleading. First of all, he says that all modern translations follow something called the critical text. What most people are referring to is this, at least the New Testament. I don't have the Masoretic text. It's over at the house. I didn't want to go grab it. So, but this is the Greek text. This is something called the Nestle-Aland. This is 27. They do have a 28 now that just came out a couple years ago. But this is Nestle-Aland 27. It's considered your critical text. But here's the thing. The NIV made their own. And it does not follow the Nestle-Aland 27. It is their own text. They just kind of did their own thing. Which, again, fair enough. That's fine. But he made it sound like everybody's using the standard text and we're all doing the same thing. That is not true. The NIV in particular made their own critical text, made their own critical apparatus, and made their own calls. Again, there's nothing wrong about that. It's just misleading to make it sound like everybody's using the same text. Most of your translations will follow this. NIV 2011 will follow that. So it was a little misleading on their end to kind of say that. There's also a little bit of confusion. You'll notice he attacked the King James Version pretty hard. I want to stop that too for a couple reasons. One of the things that is misleading is he's making it sound like there's a, he's making it sound like there's a point A, and then all this time passes, and then there's a point B, and then all we got to do is go far enough back, and we'll get to point A, or at least as close as we can possibly get. Again, it's misleading. That's not necessarily the way it works. Very early on in the realm of text and like manuscripts, we have what has been identified, we call them two families. We have what's called the Alexandrian text, and we have the Byzantine text. The base of your King James Version is the Byzantine text. The base of the NIV is the Alexandrian text. There's going to be some differences. Now, like he said, most of them are very minor. They're not real big differences, but they're there. Should you keep a King James Version around? I think so. I personally would suggest it. He talks about how archaic the language is. He's right. But the other part of that is also true. And I always bring this point up, and it's a small point, but it's also a very valid point. The King James, while the language is archaic, maintains some verbal aspects that newer translations miss. The newer translations don't miss them because they're bad translations. They miss them because that aspect of a verb has fallen out of our language. So for instance, and this is always the one I give because it's the easiest one for everybody to understand, is simple this. When I say you, how do you know I'm not talking to you or the whole group? English has no way of telling the difference. You is just you. So I can say you, or I can say you, and I can either mean a whole group or I can mean you as an individual. Archaic English made a difference. Your King James Version will make a difference. And if you read it enough and you understand some of that archaic language, you can begin to understand that, oh, Jesus is saying you to an individual right here, but he's saying you to a group right here. Break out your old King James Version and go read John 3 again. It'll blow your mind, right? Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, and it's you singular, you singular, you singular. And all of a sudden, right about in the middle of it, maybe even a little towards the end, he starts saying you plural. In the English, you guys have read John 3 how many times? And you probably never picked that up. There's a little footnote on the bottom, don't worry, to let you know. But most people just skim right past those footnotes. If you read it in the King James Version, you won't miss it. It's very obvious. It's like a whole different thing. Just laid out for you. So that's some of the differences that you face with that. And I do want to cover a few things. The use of multiple translations. I do think he's right. If you're in a serious study, if you want to seriously study the Bible, using multiple translations is a good tool. And it's a good way to do it. A translation, though, and I also like that he said this, a translation is ultimately an interpretation. And it is. You saw at least some of that whenever he was pointing some of these things out. And so you get a general idea of exactly what we're talking about, at least hopefully. He introduces you to textual criticism. I talked a little bit about that already. Give me just a second. Now this is a very common saying, especially inside textual criticism. The harder reading is generally right. And that's correct. Most of the time. But most of the time doesn't mean all of the time. And while it's a good principle to think about, it's not always necessarily a good principle to base everything on. He kind of slided over this and made it sound like it was real simple. You just do this and, hey, the harder reading is going to be the right one. It's not always the case. Sometimes they have what they call, for instance, ellipsis. You know, have you ever noticed, like, have you ever been reading something and you'll notice that the end of the sentence is the same on two different lines? Your brain will pick up on the second one. You'll miss like a whole sentence and a half. And you'll pick up on the last sentence. Hey, that happens. And it's called ellipsis. Sometimes scribes did that. And when they did that, it was a very difficult read that made no sense whatsoever. It was most definitely the harder reading, but it wasn't right. Because the right reading contained that extra sentence and a half that actually made some kind of sense. So there's things like that that occur. You know, you can go on for days. Textual criticism is a very, very complex field. I like the way you said it was a science and an art. There is a certain truth to that. You know, when you're dealing with an ellipsis, you kind of have to make a judgment call. Is this an ellipsis or is this something else? There is the art part of it. Sometimes you have to make judgment calls. That being said, again, this is just, again, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this just because it is a very complex field, but you can ask questions if you'd like. Here's what I really like. I really liked the way he put this, formal equivalence versus functional equivalence. I don't like the way he spread out the various translations. I think he was incorrect. I do, however, like the way he put it. I love this way of chart, of thinking about it. I think this is spot on. The reason I say I disagree with him is because, and quite frankly, even if you go to multiple sources, they're going to tell you that basically in the realm of formal equivalence versus functional equivalence, an ESV and an NIV are pretty close to the center. The NIV has a tendency to focus a little bit more on the functional equivalence, and it basically gives up some of its formal equivalence. The ESV is on the other side of the spectrum. It tends to be more formal equivalent, giving up a little bit of that functional equivalence. But both of them are really close to the center. And so he put the ESV way, way, way over on the formal equivalence right next to the NASB. That's incorrect. The ESV is not way over there. And the NIV is certainly not the most central ground. You can even see that in the example he gave you, right? The scribes of the Pharisees, or the scribes and the Pharisees. The NIV has teachers of the law who were Pharisees. That's a completely different text. It's trying to explain it to you, which goes on the side of functional equivalence. Let me see here. Again, for study purposes, yes, you should probably have both. It is helpful. But this is for study purposes. If you're going to just pick up a Bible and read, the NIV or the ESV are both tend to be good. I'm not going to hammer against the NIV because it takes some liberties. It really is easy to read. The problem is it does take some theological liberties, which is why we don't use it in church. In church, it would be incorrect to use. Again, some of the theological liberties it takes are downright atrocious. But if you're just reading it straight through, pick up an NIV. They're good. By the way, I'm not talking about the 1984 edition. I am talking about the 2011 edition. 1984 edition was great. It's a great Bible. I think I have a little bit more. All right, this is the word I tried to tell you guys about yesterday, or not yesterday, last week. Eisegesis or eisegogics. Do separate. Notice this one is EI. If it starts with an I, it's a different word and means something completely different entirely. You have to say that because otherwise people get confused. For instance, if you have this word starting with an I and it was eisegogics or eisegesis, that actually just means the introduction of a book. Eisegesis means to read into something. One of the serious problems of the functional equivalents is that they have a tendency to have eisegogics. Eisegesis. They read stuff into the text. Anytime you start getting into rendering idioms, you're going to run into this problem. It is a problem that you're going to have, right? If you're going to render an idiom, you're going to have to make a judgment call of what you think that idiom actually means. Realize nobody speaks ancient Greek. And while modern Hebrew is trying to revive the ancient Hebrew, it's not quite the same. It's close. It's really, really close. But some of the idioms still don't make a whole hill of beans. They don't make a whole lot of sense. Scholars to this day still don't know what it means to boil a goat in its mother's milk. Yet, that is something that is prohibited in Leviticus. We're not to do that. Why? We have ideas. Some people say it's an idiom for something. Yeah, don't do this, and here's the idiom. But we don't know why, because we're not alive from 3,000 years ago. So there is a little bit of confusion. The problem with eisegesis is it tries too hard to smooth out text. We had this text that we would go through whenever we were a steward. It was a weird text. It's in John. It's in the Gospel of John. It's in chapter 7. Jesus talks about, he's talking to a group of Pharisees, and he says, I'm not going to go up to the feast because my time has not yet come. And then the Pharisees leave, and they go up to the feast, and then the text says, and then Jesus went up to the feast. In the Greek, that text is very jagged. It's almost hard to translate. It's hard. It causes you to think things over and go, okay, what's going on here? If you were to read the NIV, you would not have a problem with that at all. It eliminates the problem and it translates and interprets it for you so that you can just read it and keep on going and you'll go, well, I don't know what the big deal is. They're reading into the text and trying to, quote unquote, fix it. There are some other issues as well. Some of them I bring out. For instance, one more, and then I'll stop, I promise. The NIV has obey, where keep should be. So for instance, a lot of times Jesus will say, if you love me, you will obey my commandments, right? It says it all over the place. The problem is that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Now I know, to us moderners, we hear that and we go, well, what's the difference? Here's the difference. The word keep there is word for tending sheep. It's not a word for keep in terms of adherence. They're two different words. NIV translates it for you and says obey. That's what Jesus obviously meant. He wants you to obey. But the problem is that's not necessarily what the word means. The word means to guard or to watch over. And so the way we have a tendency to look at it is Jesus is telling us, if we love him, we will guard and watch over his word. We will keep it close to our heart. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want to make it sound like we can go and disobey God's word whenever we feel like it. Obviously, there's a certain aspect that that's part of it. I'm just saying that's not the major thrust of what Jesus is saying. The NIV interprets it for you and is going to say, no, Jesus means you have to obey. However, the ESV keeps it as, well, keep. So again, a little bit more literal, sure, you can still see how they can get that understanding, but it's the only place that you're going to get it. Uh,